Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles, but we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin sale pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black women and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die. NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Thank you for having me, Trevor.
What a pleasure. When I heard that you were in town, I made sure, I ran around and made sure that my diary fitted you in there. Thank you for creating the time to join us.
And thank you for inviting me.
Shall we, before I go there, let me just, let people out there know that you are founder and owner of medical clinics.
Correct.
In the U.S., known as the Bell Family Medical Centers.
Mm-hmm.
You are a diplomat.
Mm-hmm.
You are a public speaker. You are an educator. You are an entrepreneur. Of that entire bouquet, what do you enjoy the most?
Mommy.
I missed out mommy there.
And Gigi.
And grandmother.
And grandmother. No. Grandmothers are old. I'm Gigi.
You're Gigi.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That's AKA grandmother.
You know, the beauty about this show is that I learn every time. So let's start with what I think is a controversy. You're being appointed to be the AU permanent representative to the U.S. The 3 years that you spent there and the way you left that position. Talk to me in the first instance about what you consider to be your achievements and why the parting had to be so public. And you had people campaigning, writing campaign letters to have you reinstated. But let's start with what was your mandate? What did you go there to do? What do you consider to be achievements? And why this ugly parting?
Okay. And I think it's interesting that when, before we came on the air, you said, oh, let's start with the controversy. And I'm like, what controversy?
Right.
And also, I felt like, you know, a lot of people felt sorry for me. And I'm like, no, it was this, you know? Because when I went to Washington, I was an odd cup, an odd peak. I am a scientist through and through. I'm a little girl from Chivu in Zimbabwe, left here after high school. Went to college, first degree in general chemistry, second degree in organic chemistry, then on to medical school, residency in general surgery, residency in family medicine, straight on private practice for 25 years. Scientist through and through. And you got a call at 3 in the morning to say, oh, we want you to go be a diplomat in Washington. I'm like, are you kidding me? So I wake up, I think it's a dream. I ask my husband, are you sure? Did you hear this conversation? And then what follows is a few months of back and forth, and finally I thought, you know what, I have not been on sabbatical since I actually left Zimbabwe. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go and spend about 6 months in Washington, hang around a little bit and drink coffee and be wine and dine, and I'll be back. And I knew that for a fact that I would be back. So I went to Washington really feeling stupid. And I'm supposed to be the AU ambassador, and I know nothing about diplomacy. Why are you guys doing this to me? So if you think you're going to make a fool out of me, well, the joke is on you, because I'm not staying. 6 months, I'm out of here, you know? But 5 months into it, I was staying in a hotel, because I didn't want to waste my time getting a place to stay. But what I began to see, the Zimbabwean revolutionary in me, I didn't know I was a revolutionary.
The circumstances cause us to realize who we are.
There were some things I'm like, there's something wrong with this picture. No, that shouldn't happen. And after many times of attending meetings in North America, back in Africa, and I see things happening that were just blatantly wrong. And I just could not sit anymore and have these people think as we leave the meeting that they put wool over me and they got away with it. So one day I just decided, I'm done. This just doesn't sit well with me. So I called my husband. I said, I need to hang around and kick his and because but it was just ridiculous. We just can't be, keep being kicked.
And I like the way you said you do the West African accent.
I did.
Yeah.
I'm actually West African. Because my husband is from Ghana.
Right.
And I said, I'm going to hang around a little bit longer. This has to stop. I mean, we just can't keep being pissed on and we do nothing. How? For how long? And then after that, I said, okay, I'm going to get a place to stay. And then I had already started traveling and speaking to the diaspora. And again, the same issue. It doesn't matter what issues I would have shared with them. Detailed information about what is really going on in Africa. France is taking over $500 billion out of Africa. And I would use a simple comparison. The watchdogs, they say corruption out of Africa sees $50 billion getting out of Africa every year.
Illicit funds.
Yes, we get that. We must go after it. But I just also told you, in the same period, France would have taken over $500 billion. The first question, invariably, Ambassador, but African leaders are corrupt. I said, what about these other thieves? Why aren't you asking me about that thief? You got two thieves. One carrying a briefcase with $50 billion, and other one carrying a briefcase with $500 billion, and you only want to talk about the one with 50. Let's talk about both.
Mm.
So with that in mind, after just going so many times, and the conversation is like, I'm not going anywhere. The people are not hearing me. So that's when I just decided one day I was on my way to yet another event with the diaspora. I called my team. I said, give me the camera. I'm going to talk. And my plan was, I'm going to do this video. Then I'm going to go to the event. Then I'm going to give them the video. So they have something to go back and listen to after what I would have said. Because I felt like I'm speaking, but they're not hearing me. So that very first video, I just did it. I was sick and tired of the French. And even politicians in Washington that I was talking to, they did not know about it. How could the world not know about such a blatant abuse from one of the five members of the UN Security Council?
Mm.
It was mind-boggling. And so I just decided that's what I was going to do. I did not realize that very first video would go viral, that people did not know. And that's how it started. I was simply, I'm just a black woman who's sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I continue to be sick and tired of being sick and tired. Because the abuse, the blatant abuse of us has got
by the worst.
To stop.
By the worst.
It has to stop. And it's going to take us as a people uniting.
Mm.
So when I started doing those videos, I was actually surprised because I just knew my days were coming to an end. And I didn't care because really, I'm making, they signed me, they actually intentionally graded me as an officer. I was being paid as an officer. It's only the last 2 months of my tenure that another ambassador had said, they're taking advantage of you. Here's what I'm making, and here's what you're making. It was only the last 2 months of my tenure that they had taken me to the level of an ambassador. Even then, they still graded me lower than most ambassadors, but at least I was in the territory of an ambassador. When I first got there, I was being paid as an officer, $49,000 a year, plus there's a small post adjustment and $3,000 housing allowance.
Mm.
So it wasn't about money. And so,
why had they sent you there?
They said they needed somebody who understood the American. So I guess I did. Maybe they were right. So as it turns out, I guess I was. But anyway, so I knew my days were numbered, and I called my husband again, and I said, oh, my days are numbered. I'll be coming home soon. But that didn't happen. The director of communications at the AU, she said, her grandfather, 92 years old, loved me. And she said, I'm going to put all the videos on the website at the AU. So all the videos were there. And then one day a phone call came. And I won't mention names, but I make friends. And so sometimes friends, they will tell me things.
Yeah.
So a phone call came, and being advised those videos must come down.
Hmm.
And so the videos came down.
So you had stepped on a number of sensitive toes.
Oh, yes. The videos had to come down. And which was fine. I was told that the videos were going to come down. I said, that's fine. But they were like, but the videos are all over the world, you know. It's ridiculous that we don't have them at the African Union. The videos
so let's just step back. The videos are the French one.
Yes.
And then which one? Which other one?
That's the main one.
That's the main one. Accusing the French of
stealing the capital. Just about everyone had a mention of the French. Because to me, they are the biggest risk to peace and security in Africa today.
The French?
The French, yes.
Why?
Can you imagine if $500 billion could stay on the continent?
Mm-hmm.
Just 1 year?
Mm-hmm.
AU itself has said, if we have 10 years of $100 billion put into Africa a year, we will complete Africa's infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
That's only 2 years of takings from France.
Mm-hmm.
So then on top of that, the peace and security issues, the wars, the coups, the support of all kinds of instabilities around the continent.
Africa.
Others are in there too, but I feel very strongly that the French are leading the pack.
Have the French responded in any way?
No, they
didn't. Or their response was to get you fired?
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. But it still, it even took 5 months. After that phone call, it was 5 months before the chairman did what
Any
he did.
Any bitterness on your side? The way you
absolutely. No, I have no bitterness. Yeah. I was ready to go home because also the office was useless. I'm sorry to say the truth. This is just the truth. They told me themselves that we are not interested in results, Ambassador. I'm not kidding you.
Wow.
The HR director told me, Ambassador, you're wasting your time. We're not interested in results. Secondly, that office had been relegated to being a protocol office. That's it. They were not expecting anything out of it.
Wow. We were chatting via WhatsApp, you said to me, I asked you, what is it that you want to talk about? And you said to me, I want to talk about people of African descent coming home to Africa.
Yeah.
This is the most important issue for me. The damage of over 400 years must be reversed.
Absolutely.
Why is this so important to you? Just unpack to us. And when this epiphany sort of emerged as something that's important that needs to be done.
I am a medical doctor. And you know, the funny thing is when I was, before I made the decision to stay, you know, I said, I'm a healer. Why am I hanging around here? What am I doing? You know, I could be saving lives on a daily basis rather than sitting around and listening to all this nonsense, you know. But I remember one day I was talking to, you know, you'd think I'd lived in America a long time. This was about 15 years ago, and I've been in America for 45. An African-American girlfriend of mine, she was visiting with me, and she said, you know, you continental Africans, you don't have to deal with the issues that we deal with. You know where you come from.
Mm.
I don't. I don't know why prior to that I'd never asked myself where I come from. I just took it for granted. But for that one moment, I did ask myself, I wonder what it feels like to not know where you come from. And it was a very painful feeling, and I quickly snapped myself out of it. But since that day, I began paying attention to my African-American friends and patients as well. And I began trying to understand. And also, this Black American experience, you know, we take it for granted, we talk about it, but it is a real entity. Black America has experienced life in the U.S. that most of us did not really understand until George Floyd. George Floyd was an everyday experience for Black America. And so George Floyd opened that door. But when you know that people are a wounded people, they don't have an anchor. When you don't know where you come from, then everything else that you do is affected by the fact that you don't have an anchor. And it's it's generation upon generation upon generation. They're living this life without ever being anchored. And it affects everything they do. And so from a healing perspective, I felt that there would be a much bigger healing process that would take place if they just could be anchored. They don't have to all come to Africa. They don't have to even come and leave if they come. But the fact that they can go to Africa. I had an experience in South America that was quite an eye-opener. I would often open my presentations with Ambassador Arikana Chiumbori-Kwao, the African Union Ambassador to the United States. I was sent here to bring you home. It was an opening line. But for some reason, when I got to South America, it was so profound for them. The fact that African Union had actually sent somebody to them to come get them, it was huge. And so as I was talking, I began to see people sharing tissues. And I thought, did I say something? So I had to sort of slowly wind down my speech because I couldn't read what was going on. And when I finally got off, the first gentleman to speak, he said, you found us. You found us. So that healing is needed. The ability to open up Africa, to say, come home if you wish. Come to stay. Come to visit. But Africa is saying, welcome home. That alone is healing in a very profound way.
Take you back to this meeting in South America.
Right.
You have come and you've said to them, I've come to take you back home. And people are in tears. What goes through your mind? What needs to be done?
First of all, the hopelessness was palpable.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen a people who were so hopeless.
Mm.
It was so painful. I think there I was left even more determined to embark on this journey to bring them home.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we don't get it. I must share something that I picked up from my pastor, T.D. Jakes, on Sunday. T.D. Jakes has discovered that his ancestry is Igbo.
Mm-hmm.
Nigeria.
He looks it too. I could have told him that.
Yeah.
I didn't need DNA testing for that one.
And he says that discovery and what it has done has been amazing in terms of affirming him and knowing who he is and where he comes from.
Yes.
And yet this is not the case with a lot of Americans.
Yes.
So help us here. So we're dealing with that. For lack of a better word, lack of foundation and background. That is affecting who we are.
Yes.
Our African-American brothers. On the other hand, we are dealing with this colonial institutional abuse on a whole people. So you're dealing with two issues here.
Yes.
How do you deal with those issues? How do we get to a place where we find a solution? I'm trying to hesitate. I'm hesitating saying closure because these are big things,
Doctor,
that you're dealing with.
But here's the thing. Understanding the genesis of it all.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, as a people of African descent, no matter where you find us on earth, we are a wounded people and we need healing. The process of wounding us might have been different, but the results are the same. When you look at the effects of colonization on the continent, the effects of slavery in the Americas, the bottom line is we are wounded. The process, the masterminding that went behind the brainwashing of the black person is universal. You take, for example, the fear of the white person by us. Well, the browbeating of the African started long before the children were taken out of Africa as slaves.
Mm.
So by the time the children were taken out of Africa as slaves, they were already brainwashed. They were already programmed to believe that Jesus Christ is white, that the angels are white, and that white people, even though they are not white like this cup over here, never mind that we are pinkish, but we are white like the angels, and you are black like the devil. We took it without question. To this very day, we take it without question. So that process, whoever came up with this mastermind, these missionaries being sent to Africa, teach them how to read, but not how to reason. It was a systematic process of demoralizing us and making us accept fifth-class citizenship position. It was applied equally.
And absolutely. It's still going on.
To this day.
So the two-legged monster, the associated to one slavery and then the other on colonialism, the $500 billion that's going on, hence Black Lives Matter, hence all those things that are taking place. Those two issues are still going on. And like we said off air, Dr. Arikana, these are big things.
Yeah.
You sound like a lone voice.
That's okay. There are many others coming up. Did you see that video about this young Kenyan girl? There was some French Africa Youth Summit. Mm. Macron, what you doing?
Yeah.
Trying to create, I guess, more informants out of Africa. I hope the young people who were watching that learned something. We cannot be used anymore. But anyway, this young girl from Kenya, she said, Mr. President, I'm going to talk to you the way my president will not talk to you. Mm. And this girl went off and really gave it to Macron.
Furthermore, the breakdown in understanding what France fully stands for is fueled by the continued collaborations that France has with agencies, leaders, and individuals who have glaring integrity issues, whilst on the other hand, claiming to be standing for human rights. So on one hand, we have France that is entrenched in issues around racism, around exploitative dominance, and whilst on the other hand, they're still claiming to teach others about democracy.
We need more young people like that. So they're coming. It's the young man in Mali who shot down a French drone with a catapult. So they're coming. The voices are there. They're not as many, but they're
why,
coming.
At your point about the Kenyan girl
mm-hmm.
speaking to Macron, why are our presidents not standing up?
You know, to be
to
honest
speak
with you,
about the things that are wounding us. Talk to me about that.
To be very honest with you, I don't envy any of the African heads of state. They're fighting with both hands, not only tied, but they're tied in their backs. At least if their hands were tied in their front, they could hit with their hands. Their hands are tied behind their backs. Let me start with the 14 countries that are former French colonies. Let me just give you a synopsis of the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization. At independence, they had to give up 85% of their bank reserves, turn them over to the French Treasury. Now that has come down to about 60%. And if they wanted some of that money, they had to submit a financial statement. And if approved, you could only access 20% of what you deposited the year before as a loan at commercial interest rate. France would take your deposits of the 14 countries, invest them in the French Treasury under their name. You don't have to know what the returns are. Your language of instruction is French. Your minerals discovered, yet to be discovered. France has first right of refusal. Your military, it has to be trained by France. You can acquire all your military equipment from France. Do you think they're going to give you the best?
Mm.
France.
You've left out one important one, assimilation, cultural assimilation.
Yes, and then French military is going to be present in your countries and may invade you without notice if they feel their interests are being violated. What are those interests? A president saying, well, we need our money. We cannot continue to turn over our bank reserves. That's a violation. You could be invaded. And they did. Men were killed. There were coups. They were exiled. So now you take a leader who has given up his finances, he has given up his military, he has given up his natural resources, he is left with 15% of his bank reserves. Now you say to him, why can't you feed your people? Let's be real here.
Let's be real, but why is that leader allowing that to happen? He's got the people to support him,
no,
to revolt against this.
He
no,
doesn't.
Can't.
Look at what we have right now in Africa. These people are forever supporting opposition. So even if opposition they are supporting today wins, tomorrow they no longer support them. Whoever is opposition, that's who they support. Serious man is going to support opposition. Serious man is going on to support all these quote-unquote terrorists. We don't have a single gun manufacturing plant in Africa. Where are the guns? Follow the guns.
Mm.
If you follow the guns, you know where the money is coming from. You know where who the real enemy is. If you look at the situation, I was listening to President of Barbados. She hit the nail in the head when she was talking about the funds for terrorism and money laundering. She said when they were looking for money laundering from Russia, they didn't come to Africa. They didn't go to the Caribbean. then you know exactly where to go. Are you with me?
I'm with
you. So let's stop playing games here.
Mm.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah, they know what they're doing, and I hear you, but I want to see whether there's any accountability on us.
Absolutely. We are accountable. Here's how I summarize it very simply. You are the bully, and you're taking 80% of my lunch every day. And then because you're the bully, and you got the money, now all you want me to do is highlight how I'm failing to make it with the 20%. But you don't want me to talk about the 80% that you're taking from me. So now we are foolish enough to be allowed, our own people, to be used to highlight the failures within the 20%. Yes, we could do something with that 20%. But golly, if that pie was bigger, if this would stop taking my 80%, pardon my language, but it is the truth. You know, I'm saying let's come together, deal with this. And I'm sorry, but I'm going to say it because it needs to be said.
But
they need to stop taking our lunch.
And I hear you. And I'm coming back to you and saying, yes, they, let's stand together and ask for them to account for the 80%. Let's stand together.
Ah, my brother, I'm trying. You have 6 people in your family. 3 are getting brown envelopes to say what they want them to say. There are so many brown envelopes running around Africa. So the question then becomes, how do we train the African not to be used as an instrument of your own self-destruction? That's where we need to go back to.
I'm going to throw the question back at
just
you.
Mind.
How do we do it?
Speak the truth. Let's teach our children our history. Our people do not know our history. We need to arouse the spirit of Pan-Africanism in each and every one of us. And let our children know when you are being used. So, for example, you get these young people, they are being invited to go to Europe by all these different NGOs. No, they are recruiting you. Take the money, but don't be abused.
What about our African heads of state?
Who,
allow me to finish.
Mm-hmm.
They fly to China, all of them, to meet one man.
Now that's
okay. Hold me. Let me finish.
Yes.
Then they fly to Europe
for
the EU summit.
Right.
Then all of them fly in 50 planes to America to go and meet with Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
You've said the people are brainwashed. Yes, but what about our presidents? Shouldn't it start there?
Well, you're quite right.
Have they been given brown envelopes?
I don't know. I can't speak to that. But what I can say is, there are areas we could do better. For example, you look at the United Nations. The largest voting bloc at the UN is the African bloc. We don't have a seat at the table. If they could all just come together and say, we are not coming, this institution is not for us, see how quickly things will change. But again, if it's not a brown envelope, it's all other things that can, if you do this, we will stop this. If you don't vote with us on this, these are the consequences. So there are always other things that are being threatened with, that if you don't do it, this is what's going to happen to your country. I can tell you with what I know right now, the majority of the African heads of state, they truly want what's best for their people. We have a few that could do better, but the majority really want what's best for their people. I was very proud of a lot of the heads of states this year at the UNGA. All of them came strongly in support of
sanctions against Zimbabwe. Mm.
And a lot of them were very Pan-African. So it's coming. But if there's that fear of instability within their country, so as much as a leader might want to behave a certain way, but there are consequences that they have to look at and say, is it really worth it? What's going to happen to my people? So you end up, I'm going to share with you, it was one particular country. I won't mention the country. I got a phone call. There was a tender.
Can we play guess the country?
You can if you want. But there was a tender. I can tell you it was a French-speaking country. there was a tender that was coming out. And it was a company out of another African country, English speaking, that was going to get, that did the best bid. And 50% what the French company was bidding for. So when it was obvious that the bid was going to go to this other African company, they were forced to give the bid to the French company. How I got involved, because now there was some smart person in that country who was saying, if somebody could leak this information to the media, then we can have, because they were going to serve the country 50%, but we're talking billions of the contract. And so I just heard about it, but before I knew it, they managed to get it on BBC. So it was on BBC. It had to go on BBC before they would come back and say, hey, now the people know. We really can't do this. Yeah. You know? And that's how this other company got the bid. You see the game they have to play. But within the country, no one could come out and speak about it. Because there would be serious consequences. We must be very clear about one thing in Africa. The hidden hand is real. The hidden hand is strong. And the hidden hand is very powerful. That is where we need to begin. Everything else that follows is a consequence of. We must understand the enemy. That big, powerful, strong, hidden hand. Let's deal with it. But for us to deal with it, we must understand it. And our people must understand it. So yes, we must hold our heads of state accountable. But again, back to the two men with briefcases. 50 billion and 500.
500 billion.
Yeah, we need an army for the smaller army for the 50 billion, a 10 big times game. Bigger army
yeah.
for 500 billion. It's the game of war. We must strategize.
So your institute, the African Diaspora Development Institute, are you making headway?
I just want to bring the children of Africa home.
Yeah, okay.
Because we understand the diaspora are Africa's true gold. Think of the brains that are in the diaspora. Think of the monies in the diaspora. If we can just repatriate those brains, repatriate those monies in an organized way, we don't need anybody. We are actually the only continent on earth that doesn't need the world. The world is Africa. Everybody knows it. There's not a single strategic planning session by any country around the world outside Africa that doesn't start with Africa. Because everything they need can and is being found in Africa. So we have what it takes, and they know it. You know, they're very jealous of us. They're actually very envious of what we have as a people. So not only have they gone after our natural resources, now they're going after our human resources. You see, they've gone for so many decades of reduced reproductive process. Now, the age gaps in their nations, huge. They are now looking for people to take care of them when they age.
Is the diaspora, you spoke about the your meeting in South America, is the diaspora ready to come home? Do they have any concerns about coming to Africa as
kids? Well, let me say this. We are making headway. The Pan-African conversations are increasing. I belong to a lot of platforms. I don't post, but I just follow. I love the conversations that are coming out. Is that enough? Not by any stretch of imagination. We need a lot more people to understand the issues. We find a lot, like, for example, Zimbabwe. We just don't understand what's going on. This is an amazing country.
Beautiful country.
Beautiful country. One of the safest countries to live in, and yet it's painted as top 10 worst countries to live in. One of the best countries to invest in. Opportunities that are so low hanging. But they don't know that. The president said, and I'm going to say it in our language, Nyika inovakwa nevenevayo. People must understand the country is going to be built by its people.
Absolutely.
But the people must be in the know. If the people do not know, how can they build their country? So to the Zimbabweans, I say, take some time. Because if you are going to say, we don't like the government, therefore we're not going to Zimbabwe. Well, guess what? If opposition wins next time, there's now going to be another 50% that don't like opposition. Mm. So what's going to happen to your mother in the village? Mm. She didn't get anything done because you were mad at the ruling party. Then the next time another party comes in, your mother is still going to be the loser because nothing is going to get done because the opposition is fighting. How long are we going to wake up and say, Albert Einstein, insanity, is doing the same thing over and over again. And expecting a different result? No, we work with the current government, we make them accountable, we engage them at the highest level, we demand change. We demand that we, at the end of the day, it's about building that strong private sector. Nothing stops you from
what you're saying, sorry to bump in, because I think your finger is on a very important thing, which is know the difference between your political party and your country.
Exactly.
That we can differ on which party I support. But when it comes to my country, the flag and my country, you can't touch me.
Absolutely.
Is that what you're saying?
Development is development.
Yeah.
If a bridge is built, the current president is not going to destroy it when he leaves. That just means the next president must come in and expand on that bridge.
Mm.
You know, put irrigation over that bridge. Develop it, advance it. But we need to look at it and say, what have I done to build my country, to contribute towards the building of my country? Politics or no politics? But they think government must give us this. Government must... No! Government paves the way. But you must be available. They come to me all the time. Ambassador, the Chinese... I said, well, what about the Chinese? I said, the Chinese are getting the contracts because you're not there. I was talking to one of the, I think it's the Zambian Development Agency, and he says, Ambassador, I have Chinese lined up on my door every day. Not any of my people, let alone the diaspora. So why are you complaining about the Chinese? You are not there. Because if you were there, they would not get the contract. You are not there until you are ready to stand up, until you are ready to put your monies together, believe in each other, rather than continue to complain. Guess what? They love it when you continue to complain.
Mm.
So they can move in and take what belongs to you. The joke is on you.
Let's move on to something very important and related, which is xenophobia on the continent. And Ghanaians kicking out, was it Nigerians kicking out Ghanaians?
But I think they've learned
Somalia,
South Africa.
It's the concept.
But Ghanaians have learned, though.
Mm.
Even Nigerians have learned from the mistakes they made. To think of all countries, though, South Africa is a sad story. With everything the world did to liberate South Africa, it goes back again to the children don't know our history. They don't know the struggles. So we, as elders, we have a responsibility to keep hammering that message home.
Because the Pan-African message then becomes, it's a much more higher level. When you're having to deal with people who, I call it, I think the appropriate word is Afrophobia. It's almost the fear of Africans or the hatred of Africans.
But it goes back to colonization. We're programmed to dislike each other. Did you see the little video that's been going around? A little black boy, around five years of age, given two dolls, the black and the white doll. Says, which one is ugly? Points at the black doll. Which one is beautiful? Points at the white doll. Which one is mean? Points at the black doll. Which one is nice? Points at the white doll. Which one looks more like you? He goes, very sad. So that child is going to grow up to be the president of the country.
And yet?
That's his mindset.
Yeah.
That's how he sees the world. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even like himself. He says, I'm mean, I'm ugly.
Mm-hmm.
The subliminal messages are deep.
The subliminal messages are deep. The assignment is deep.
Yes.
The heavy lifting is huge.
Huge.
Because changing people's mindset is tougher than building infrastructure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is the biggest issue Africa has to deal with. The absolute most dangerous human being for Africa today.
Words. And I think the emotions are strong. When you're talking, I sense it. The emotions are raw.
Yeah.
This is no pretend business.
No.
How much of this is because you've spent 45 years in America?
It has nothing to do with spending 45 years in America. I think it has more to do with the life I lived in Zimbabwe during apartheid Zimbabwe. I had a very traumatic experience personally, and my father had a traumatic experience. He was still alive when our land was taken from us. If you remember, the British, if you were a veteran of the First or Second World War, you were guaranteed 2,000 hectares of land in Zimbabwe, plus any loot from the local people. I want to repeat that. If you were a veteran, a British veteran of the First or Second World War, you were guaranteed 2,000 hectares of land in Zimbabwe, plus any loot from the local people. So it is. A white man would land in Zimbabwe. They had divided our country into regions, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1 and 2 were the best. Best rains, best soil for farming. 3 was kind of mixed, good for ranching. 4, nobody should live there. There's the flies, mosquitoes. So they were pushing us away from the good parts of the country. And so the white British men would be sent in this direction. You put your peg, you get up in the morning, you ride a horse in one direction until either you or your horse is tired. You put your peg, that's day one. Get up second, day one, day two, day three, day four. And when you're done, everything in it is yours. So it was time for them to come to my, our part of the country. And my father was a young man of around 13 years old, and he still remembers it. He just remembers this hush-hush talk among the elders. And the following morning, he was woken up early morning with, they called them men without knees. When white men were wearing pants, they looked like they have no knees. So he talks of men without knees riding on horses, and they were torching the village. They were torching the village. And he remembers, you know how we keep firewood in a shape like this?
Yeah.
He went and hid between the firewood. And he saw it all come out. And apparently his aunt was pregnant and due to deliver any day. So the elders had asked for permission if she could be allowed to stay. So they felt that maybe if they kept a young child, their chances of getting killed by these men without knees were less. So they kept him as the young child. So it was the aunt, her husband, another aunt who was the midwife. It was himself and another sister to the one who was pregnant. They were all huddled in this hut. Unfortunately for them, it took about 3 weeks for her to deliver. And every morning, the man on the without knees on his horse would come to find out if she had delivered. The rest of them, they left with whatever they could carry. Their chickens, their goats, their cows, their donkeys. They were all taken by the men without knees because they were told, everything is yours. So they left with whatever they could carry. And he remembers how scared he was every morning that that man without knees was going to come in and kill them. So 3 weeks of torture and scared about this man without knees. And no sooner had they joined, and we, that's how we just got to split up. No sooner had they regrouped, another one came and reclaimed. In this direction, go past this mountain. In this direction, go past this river. Your land is now mine. I grew up hearing that story. So I think that's where it comes from.
Right.
And then living in the United States, and of course, initially when I went to America, I really didn't understand. I didn't even know there were that many black people in America. And I'm going to share with you a story that a lot of people are going to find quite funny. Back in the 70s, you know, our idea of a good-looking man was this black man with a big afro and putting on bell-bottom pants and platform shoes, you know. And so we used to call, the majority of those guys were coming from Nigeria. Because remember, we Southern Africans, we are descendants of the Bushmen, the Pygmies, and the Hottentots. Our hair doesn't grow. I mean, it grows, but it grows in piles, in coils. You can pick it up, it's long, but if you let go, it just goes right back in. So our men were not really having these nice big afros. So a good-looking guy with a big afro Majority were from Nigeria. So we started calling them niggers because they were from Nigeria. So I wanted my own nigger. And then we heard that there were some niggers in America. So the likes of Andrew Young was being an ambassador, and they were Caribbean. We got the Jimmy Cliffs and Bob Marley. So there were a few there, but the majority were from. So a nigger was a good-looking black man, you know.
Yeah.
So now, check this out. I find out I'm going to America. I said, yes, I'm going to get my own nigger. And then I end up going to Fisk University. I was admitted to various universities, and I had to submit which university I wanted. And I knew nothing about any of those universities, but Fisk University was in Nashville, Tennessee, and it said Music City, USA. I said, I'm going to Music City. The issue that it was a historical black college, it didn't make sense to me. What do you mean black? The uniforms are black. The walls are painted black. So I disregarded that part. So people thought I went, no, I wanted my own nigger, and I was going to the Music City. So I get to Fisk, and I'm dropped off. The taxi driver was not very nice. He just dumped me in the middle of the campus. And I look around. There are all these black people. I'm like, I'm lost. I must be in the island somewhere. Where are the white people? I'm coming to a white country, you know? But anyway, be it as it may, I hang around. My lesson on being a nigger came from my girlfriend, who was an African-American. We went downtown Nashville shopping. It was end of the day, and it was very busy. So in the pavement, I don't know if I bumped into this white man or he bumped into me, but whatever it was, he yelled at me and said, you nigger, or something like that. I didn't really say anything, but when we got to the dorm, I said to my girlfriend, you know, something is bothering me. Of all the African countries, why did that white man think I was from Nigeria? That's when I got my lesson one-on-one on being a nigger. And she took me to school. She really gave me this story. And I already was having issues because on campus at that time in the 70s, I'm black, I'm beautiful. That I'm like, why? I never said it openly.
Mm.
But I'm thinking, why are you saying the obvious? I already know I'm beautiful. You see what I'm saying? And so we had a very interesting conversation with my girlfriend. So after she gave me the full story about black America, then I thought, well, let me ask you about this thing. Why do they wear T-shirts that says I'm black, I'm beautiful? I said, I already know I'm beautiful. And she goes, yeah, tell me about that. And I said, because where I come from, beauty is not based on how you look. I was told growing up in my village, if I was a good child, I respected my elders, I did my chores, I went to school, I brought home good grades. I was a good child. The box for beauty was well defined. The box for ugliness was also well defined. The choice was yours, whether you wanted to be beautiful or whether you wanted to be ugly. And I said, you Americans, you're quick to say, oh, you're so pretty. Oh, you're beautiful. I said, I'm offended by that. And she says, why are you offended? I said, because where I come from, to call me beautiful, you have to know me.
Mm.
How do you know I'm not a mean person? I eat human beings at night. You know? I'm an ugly person because of what I do. You see what I'm saying? So you don't know me. You're not qualified to define my beauty until you know me. So I find it very fake when Americans just say, oh, you're beautiful, oh, you're this. I find it very fake because you don't know me and you're not qualified.
That appearance is superficial, isn't it?
It's superficial. Mm. So clearly, beauty that I know is based on deeds.
Clearly, these are deep lessons that you learned from your parents. This is your upbringing.
Yes.
You grew up in Chivu. Which school did you go to in Chivu? You walk me through your education at Chivu University.
You know, I did my primary school at Unyetu, but I finished at...
In Chivu?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And Unyetu Primary.
Okay.
But I finished my seventh grade at Kambuzuma High.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. And then after Kambuzuma High, I went to Gormanzi.
And the choice to study medicine, when did medicine grab you as an option?
Medicine, I did not think, remember growing up in apartheid Zimbabwe, I didn't think I was smart enough to be a doctor because we were just not allowed. The opportunities were just not there. So when I went to the United States, I thought maybe I'd become a nurse or something. But it was my chemistry instructor who, I guess, must have seen something in me. She kept pushing me. I didn't know that she was on the admissions committee at the medical school across the street. She kept pushing me. Have you applied? Have you applied? And I kept thinking, one, I have no money.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it's very difficult to get into medical school. What I had been told was that 5% of the positions in any medical school are reserved for foreigners from all over the world. And I was not going to put myself on a losing path by trying to get into an area and try year after year and not make it. So if it were not for that teacher, believe me, I don't think I would have gone to medical school.
Wow.
But she shamed me because every time she would say, have you applied? Mm. One day I lied because she had asked me so many times.
Mm.
And I said, oh, yes, I did. What I'd actually done was I'd put in an application to go to pharmacy, do graduate studies in pharmacology, and at the same medical school, because I knew medical school was a problem.
Mm.
But so what I did was I felt so bad that I'd lied to her. I said, let me just call the admissions office. And I just knew they would say no. Then I can then tell the deadline to apply for medical school was over. So I wanted to just say, I missed the deadline. You know, that would have been my exit. But when I called, I said, I have an application for pharmacy. Can I change it to medicine? Expecting her to say no. She said, sure, we can change it. I'm like, oh, snap. Okay, fine. So now they changed it. She said, have you taken the admissions test? I said, no. Come and get the registration paperwork so you can take the exam. This is January. The exam is April. Entrance is in August. So I said, okay, I'm just going to take it, and I'm going to fail it. Then I said, okay, I'll take a year and go to Zimbabwe and then come back and continue with my pharmacology.
Mm.
I take this stupid exam. I completely forgot about it. I'm now planning on going to Zimbabwe because I knew I'm going to fail it. I still remember it was the first week of August, I get a phone call from the medical school. If my husband had not been standing right there, no, he walked into the room. They called me, they said, we're getting ready to send you your admission package because the school is starting in 2 weeks. We wanted to know if you're going to accept. I said, oh, no, I can't accept, I can't afford it. So my husband heard me say that. And so I actually hung up. He said, who was that? I said, that was Mehari Medical College. He said, and you said, what? Call them back. You know, call them back right now. I said, but honey, we have no money. He said, don't worry about it. Just call them back. So I sheepishly called them back. I said, I will accept. So I accepted, not a penny in my pocket. But that's how I got medical school.
Wow.
I had no money. I'm sure in the history of Mehari Medical College, I'm probably the only doctor who graduated without paying a penny.
Isn't that amazing?
President Thatcher, who was later the Surgeon General for the United States, after my husband had coached me on all kinds of lies to tell them the money was coming from Zimbabwe by this second year, the lady in the admissions office, I walked in, she goes, so, Arikana, exactly how is this money coming from Africa? Because I've got all kinds of stories about, well, you know how things are in Africa. Now, how long can I carry that line, you know? And I just broke down and I started crying. So she did, she wrote it on a piece of paper. To this day, I can't even tell you what she wrote. But she sent me upstairs to the president's office. I kid you not, I could have peed on myself going up there. I just knew my days in medical school were finished, yeah. And I knew he was going to chastise me. You took a position that could have been taken by somebody who could really go through it. I get up there, President Thatcher, he's talking about Zimbabwe, where you come from, my family and all that. And I'm expecting when the hammer is going to come down. And after that, she signed whatever that piece of paper, handed it to me, and she said, go back down. I go back down. The woman looks at me, shakes her head, and gives me my admission packet. One semester after another, I would show up. The woman would shake her head. She'll give me a piece of paper.
How do you explain that?
I don't know. I can't explain it.
Hmm.
But that's my story.
Fascinating.
And I'm sticking by it.
And then you stick by your story. That's fine. You've now done amazing work with the Bell Family Medical Center. Talk to me about the thinking around that and what it is that you're doing.
You know, a lot of the things that I've done, it's like going to medical school. I wasn't planning on it.
Mm.
I knew I would have wanted to be a medical doctor, but I thought, the climb was too steep. I didn't think I could make it into medicine. Not that I wasn't able in terms of the material, but the process, I didn't think I would make it through the process. So the same is true with when my husband is a medical doctor. He is older than me. He was
Your husband is Ghanaian.
He's Ghanaian, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was already a medical doctor. So, because being a man, I used to laugh at him because he set me up. I never looked for a job as a doctor. I just knew I was going to have my own practice just like my husband. And so he pretty much would set up my clinics and all that. But, you know, putting all the stuff I needed in the clinic. And the reason I'm laughing at my memory of him was that, so I'd go to work in the morning, and he would have brought in some supplies, and I would call him and say, honey, where did you put this? I may be asking for a speculum. Okay, what you got? And I'm like, well, I have this patient with such and such. Okay, here's what I want you to do. I'm like, no, stop. I only asked you where the speculum is. I am seeing my own patient. I am my own person. No, he wanted to tell me what to do, you know. And so we had to go through that. Like, if I call you for a specific question because you were here last night, tell me where that item is. And if I need help with treating my patient, I will ask you specifically. But no, invariably, okay, what you got? This is what you need to do. But anyway, so my husband set me up. So that was, looking for a job as a medical doctor was never something that occurred to me. I'm a business person. My father was a business person back in Chivu. He had the first long-distance buses into our area. He had general stores. So I think it was also just the entrepreneur spirit is within me. And so I just started buying clinics, opening clinics where they ended me. And that's how it started.
What does your name mean? Does it mean anything, Arikana? That's a beautiful name.
Let me tell you, Trevor, I was supposed to be a boy. And I know you're probably thinking, what do you mean? My mother had 8 pregnancies, and the second one was a boy. The rest were girls. So I am pregnancy number 7. So by the time they got to me, my father just knew that my mother was incapable of having a boy. So he went to consult a Juju man, and this Juju man was known for the wife has to become pregnant first, and then you go there and take the Juju medicine ever so often while you're pregnant, your wife who is incapable of producing a certain sex, but that medicine that you're taking will convert the sex. So I was already known to be a girl, but the Juju medicine was going to turn me into a boy. So my father just knew that I was a boy, and he had done his research, and my name was supposed to be Erikana, the husband of Hannah in the Bible.
Yeah.
So it is I was born, and the story goes, my father was running Sadza Hospital, that's where I was born. He's running up the steps at Sadza Hospital because they knew him as a local businessman. Oh, his name was, which was a business name, Fadza Moyo. Mr. Fazumoyo, congratulations, you have a baby girl. Supposedly he shoved the nurse aside and he kept going. Gets to my room, sure enough it's a girl. My father disappears for 3 days. When he came back, he didn't feel like spending time looking for another name. So he removed the E, and he put an A, and he called me Arikana. It's a made-up name. To my surprise, this was in 2021. There was this white man I was going to be having a call with. And he says, oh, before our meeting, I did a research on your name. I love it. It's a perfect meaning that describes you. I said, sir, you're wrong. My name means nothing. My father made it up. He said, let me send it to you. Somebody has done a profile on Arikana.
Wow.
So
it's out there. It means something.
Somebody made it mean something. And I'm sure it's a Shona name. It's Zimbabwe. So if you Google Arikana, there is a meaning now. But I can assure you that name.
Do you know what the meaning is? Not yet.
I've looked it up, but
I forget it. You have been recognized. You've gotten a number of prestigious awards, Arikana.
Right.
1996 Achievement Award, 2015 African Women Excellence Award, 2019 Person of the Year by the Guardian newspaper. Which ones of these mean the most to you and why?
1996, Mandela.
Talk to me about that.
I think as a young woman at that time, to be in the same room with Nelson Mandela and President Mugabe was huge. It was just so memorable to have such icons even just know that I exist. It was incredible. It was absolutely incredible.
Mm.
So yes, just being in the presence of such icons and such history. Mm.
You have a lot of crazy ideas. One of the crazy ideas is you want to build Wakanda Village.
Right.
How is that going?
Well, Wakanda, we're looking for funding and also putting together a city. It's a job and a half. It's not easy. So we have diaspora from around the world. They work together. But we're working on it. It's a work in progress.
You've been given land, am I right?
In Ghana?
No, is it Ghana?
Yes, Ghana is one country we wanted to start. Mm. But also here, we have actually started with a community in Lusike.
Okay.
The chief there has just been king. I call them kings. I refuse to call them chiefs because the British didn't want to honor our royalty. So he is presiding over a whole kingdom. So he is a king. So I call him my king, even though they call him a chief. And he has really opened up his kingdom to us. And we are starting with three communities, three villages.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we had our little launch where we've organized the community. They have a village community committee and village subcommittees. Mm-hmm. And we are going to be just bringing in development. We are starting with the chicken project, which we are calling Chiconomy.
Wow.
If you picture a situation where the profit margin from the chickens is between 90 cents to a dollar. We started with 5,000 chicks. Our second batch, we kept it at 5 because we had the mortality was a little too high for us for the first batch. Thank goodness they have dealt with all the issues. The second batch is doing very well. Mortality is insignificant. And the next batch, which should be coming in 2 weeks, is going to be 10,000. After, in every 5 weeks, we're doubling the flock.
Mm-hmm.
10,000, then 20, then 40, then 80. So imagine when we get to 100. We're now sitting at 100,000, 90 to 100,000 profit. We are saying the subcommittees, we have education, we have healthcare, we have infrastructure, we have water and sanitation, we have energy. So when we get to 50, 10,000 is going to be put aside.
Mm.
So education, if you got $1,000 or two, what are you going to do with it?
Mm.
They may want to build a school block. Bricks are only $40 per thousand. They might say, we'll buy bricks to build a school block. What are you going to do with the next 5,000? We are going to put a roof on that building. All the way to 5 to 10 years, we can have a university.
Mm.
Because the plan is to go all the way to 500,000 chickens.
Wow.
Yes. Developing, yes. Clinic. We might start with, when you get your $1,500, what are you going to do with it? Mm. They have to defend their budget. We're going to buy paracetamol. We're going to buy bandages. We're going to buy thermometers. All the way over a period of 5 to 10 years, we're going to have a hospital. Infrastructure. Right now we're looking at, we want to pave that road from the Mutare Road in, over to the Chief's Palace. We need to grade that and we need to pave it.
Mm.
And then we just continue. As we have money, infrastructure, what are you going to do with your $1,500? Until every little footpath is graded. Electricity, we want to make sure everybody has solar panels. We want to make sure that everybody has a brick house. We want to make sure that everybody has access to water through wells.
Mm.
At least, so as you get your 1,500, and then that 1,500 will now soon be 2,000. That allocation will go up to 5,000. It just keeps increasing depending on how fast our chicken project. So we are saying, we are challenging diaspora, whatever village you come from, now you have no excuse to not
to put,
start a chicken project where you come from. If you're from Kenya, this is...
What do you call it? Chiconomy.
Chiconomy. If you're from... the blueprint is in Rusike.
Yeah.
But just tell us what village you come from. Right now, we're going to Namibia.
Mm.
One of the diaspora
from Chiconomy.
Chiconomy. We're going to Namibia on the 20th. We're going to meet with the queen there. They've invited us, and we're going to start the chicken project in Namibia. Mm.
You've got a big conference slated for April next year.
Correct.
Talk to us about that.
Okay. I've been on a 7-country tour in Africa, looking for a headquarters for ADDI. I was really avoiding Zimbabwe because I didn't want people to think I'm from Zimbabwe and I'm wanting people to come to Zimbabwe. I'm really a Pan-African. I could put a headquarters anywhere. But honestly, after traveling to seven different countries, this really was the best environment. And I think most of my people are in agreement. One of the people I met with was the former president. And I was asking him, what were you heads of state thinking when you came up with the definition of the sixth region as all people of African descent living outside Africa? I said, that definition is wrong, and it is not an equalizer. And I said, if Mr. President, you were to come to the Americas and you shout on top of your voice and say, all people of African descent, let's go home to Africa. Let's assume we could all walk across the Atlantic. But guess what's going to happen when we get to the shores of West Africa? You're going to start asking us, where are you from? This one says, I'm from Ghana. Okay, fine, go. I'm from Nigeria, go. This one, I'm from Georgia. Oh, sorry. So the definition is incomplete. What are you going to do about that? He said, well, my sister, we did our part. And that's when he took me to school. He said, since the 1900s, the likes of W.B. Du Bois have been talking about wanting to come home to Africa. They had 5 Pan-African congresses held. The UK sponsored 3, 2 in London, 1 in Manchester. France sponsored 1 in France. US sponsored 1 in the United States. By 1974, now conversation started in 1919. The president of Tanzania, Nyerere, he said the conversations about the children of Africa coming home must be held on the African soil. So he sponsored the 6th Pan-African Congress, which was the first one to be held in Africa. Again, we met, but no deliverables. President Museveni of Uganda, 20 years later, in 1994, he said, let's regroup. The children of Africa must come home. So he sponsored the 7th Pan-African Congress. He said, we have been listening to the cries of the children of Africa. So when we got to where we were restructuring the OAU in 2002, we incorporated the 6th region as part of the African Union Constitution. He says, now the ball is in your court. You're confused, disorganized African diaspora. We need a truly representative group of African diaspora to come together, find a host country, talk about your issues, and bring your issues to us. We will listen. But that has not happened. We have not had a truly representative group. It cannot be a small group from South America, a small group from the United States, a small group from Europe. It has to be representation from every corner of the globe where people of African descent reside. And he says, Ambassador, if you can do that, I'll support you. He said, I'll even get my own president to host, because you need a host country. I said, well, thank you. He took me to school. Thank you, Mr. President. Now I'm armed with knowledge. So I continued my travels. But the more I thought about it, I thought, really, Zimbabwe could use that. And so I met with the president. I presented my visit with this other former president. And he agreed to host the 9th Pan-African Congress. Because there have been 2 others, one in South Africa in 2012, one in Ghana, but they were aborted. The people were self-serving. For whatever reason, it was aborted. So here we are. We are busy promoting the spirit of Pan-Africanism, promoting the Pan-African Congress. What does it mean to you as an individual, as a person of African descent? One of the reasons also that we, among others, that we moved it from October, we only had 9 people from South and Central America. That wasn't going to work. The majority of the slaves were taken to South and Central America. People don't realize that. So we need a significant representation from South America if the outcome of our deliberations are going to be meaningful and truly representative.
Did you have a date now?
Yes, 19 to 16 of April. We're just waiting for final confirmation of the availability of the president. But we're trying to tie it in with, that was also a point raised by the foreign ministry. We want to tie it in with independence, which is the 18th.
Fantastic.
So yeah, we are looking forward to bringing the children of Africa home. Key discussions are going to be pathway to citizenship and establishment of the 6th region headquarters. We want to come home in a big way. We want to be just like ECOWAS. We want to be like SADC. We just want to be a true 6th region. And, of course, we have to have our headquarters outside Africa for sure. But we want to be a true 6th region with representation at the African Union. No one is advocating for the African diaspora. That has got to stop. Mm. You can't just proclaim 6th region and run off. We want true representation. And that's what we're going to be demanding. And we will have our Victoria Falls. We are going to call it AKA Mosiwatunya Declaration, because we don't want to use Victoria Falls. We can't continue to honor somebody who has done nothing for us. So we'll have a Mosiwatunya Declaration. We'll hand it over to our president. We hope that he will share it with his brothers and sisters who are members of the AU, all the African heads of states. And we take it from there.
We wish you the best.
Thank you.
Wow. We could go on and on. You know?
I know.
I mean, we could go on and on. You are an author.
I didn't realize that, but I...
You are an author. You have written an Amazon bestseller, Africa 101. I haven't read it, I must say, but it's on my list to read because I think I'm going to be educated, like you've educated all of us today, about Pan-Africanism. It's called The Wake-Up Call for Africa. I'm looking forward to reading.
But in order not to have this African problem of start, stop, again, start, and stop again, and usually if you draw a graph, this start, stop business is driven by change of leadership, individuals that come into office, they believe in this thing, they believe in that thing. We must, in agreeing with him, institutionalize. Legislate positive Zambia and others in our region. Common interests the welfare of the people, common infrastructure, as the president said, Kachima Mulilo Bridge. Some of you talked about the single window. Total agreed. So that we don't at that Kachima Mulilo Seshek. So we can view the goods that are being carried in a truck, even when it's still 20 kilometers before the border. Scanning it, isn't it? Technology. Shared technology. But the border infrastructure. Common rules around there, Mr. President. We're ready for that. But where we are failing, lead us and drag us on as governments. And you'll find palatable governments, supportive governments. Mr. President, I chose to focus on these issues rather than certain other issues, because that's practical. And if the truck can move quickly through there, and the issue of the rail line, I think there was a mention of the rail line again. That's far from your end. It's our duty now, Minister of Commerce. Your colleague is not here, infrastructure, but you represent your colleagues, to begin to share this vision of what's happening in Namibia, on the Namibian border side, what we should be doing on the Zambian border side, because there's no point Namibia does certain things and we slow Namibia's initiatives when they enter our border. We will be a negative factor. So sharing at that early level and maybe common infrastructure development. Common infrastructure development. I think at some point we were at the EU Africa Summit and they were talking of the EU Africa Infrastructure Plan. And I think this is where the two governments, ministries, business people quickly meet and say, how do we package these common infrastructure projects? Kazungula, where we met, Kasani, is one fantastic project. But it took so many years talking about talking and when to talk next. When you meet like this, the two of you seated next to each other, part of what you're doing is to network, to nudge us in government to say, hey, 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 too slow here. Let's go. And you'll find us amenable as a third generation. Generation not just by age. Generation by the way we see things, given the operating environment. I think that's the issue really here. And how can it not be on the basis of working together, teamwork, partnership? How can we achieve these things? Just a few things that the president said, and I'm just adding on. I'm always careful when I'm him, with him. Eh? Very good. He hasn't paid attention. Yeah. So he doesn't catch me on the wrong side. Eh? So, truly speaking, this is a great opportunity. I know our head commissioner is here, his president. Thank you for receiving him. So we must fire from all engines, all cylinders. The high commissioner, the other one is here. Where is he? Namibia. There you go. The two of you should be talking about issues that we are meeting for here. The two of you should be talking about how you can quickly help us unlock these issues, sitting with the business community colleagues. Not sitting with us only, President. We may have other issues of priority. But you nudge us to get the work done to open up trade investment. That will lead to jobs. If there's a union colleague here, that will lead to new members signing up into your union. We actually need you, the union, so that we can sit together and talk about issues that may be reducing productivity. How can we improve productivity? I guess you will see, you try and go this direction, if you really look at what you are discussing or you're doing properly, you find yourself back to a table of a tea, but sitting in different corners, but for one agenda. Mr. President, I said to colleagues that some of whom I went to school with in Europe, after UNSA, of course, University of Zambia, and some of my friends about this culture, that I'm an investor, I'm not a politician, I'm an investor, I'm a businessman. I said, you do business in heaven, or you do business on earth, and in which part of the earth you do business in? You can't say I'm this, I don't have little time, or I've no time for President HH or Servant HH, President Gengo. You have to have time, because it's an operating environment which can slow you down, or if you like, accelerate, ameliorate some of the negatives that you face. So we are in it together, Mr. President. And here, if there's any message I want to send at this beautiful expo, in this Swakopo moon, it is to say, let us work together. President Gengo is seated here. He's got many other things to do. As I told you when he invited me, that I'm coming. Sir, I'm coming, Mr. President, I'm coming. I thought it's my time to say things I say to colleagues back home, because he's now gotten used to this record, and I'll continue playing it. We make it work in Namibia, it will help Zambia. We make things work in Zambia, it will support Namibia. And eventually Namibian people, Zambian people will be better off, either by a job, quality job, given our youthful population, very youthful population in our countries. We were chatting with the president again, and Zambia probably is worse, given the quantums of numbers. We have to create jobs. If it's not a job, before a job, we have to send a child to school. And we're chatting again. I love our conversation. But why do we think that getting a BSc, a BA, is the definition of education? A doctorate in aeronautics, even when the aeronautic industry is in our country, is not there. But we ignore artisan school skills. Mr. President, when I was younger, when I was an undergraduate at UNSA, we had a lot of plumbers in our country and carpenters. Now, in my days in business, I'm looking for a plumber. I can't get a quality plumber. So what happened? The skill disappeared. But yet it's the most basic and critical of the skills. Plumbing, welding, you know, carpet. So let's redefine if there's an educational institution here at this expo. Can we redefine our curricula? Can we look at it properly? Together with the industry. Going forward, Mr. President, I agree with you, as the third generation of leaders, we don't want an educational institution designing curricula on their own without the business sitting with them. Doesn't make sense. Because we have to have curricula that meets the needs, not just of scientists, but also of the basic life skills. Then will be useful. But ultimately, back to my colleagues that we met in our days in school in Europe, that investing in Namibia and Zambia and SADC and Africa, it's a must that you must find local partners. It is a must. It's good for you. It is good for you. I'm not just saying Europe. I'm saying China, America, Japan. The best insurance policy you can have is to have local partners. Why? When the leadership of him comes to an end, President Gengo, who believes in what he's sitting here for, when our time ends, you will have entrenched your business in the local community, interwoven in a way that any one weird leader who comes in future and starts talking of expropriation, you don't have to answer first. Who will answer? It's your local partner. He has to go. That leader, he or she has first to break down the very citizens that they assumed public office before you engage with him. I think you see the sense I'm talking about. Let us work together to develop our businesses. Without business, without trade, without investment, it's practically impossible to deliver any better life for anyone in our country. Not even water, clean water. I was asking the president again, what is that pipe? I'm a bit inquisitive myself. What's that pipe? The gentleman was extracting water. He said, where is this water going? He said, oh, to feed people. But this is sea water. It's salt water. He said, yeah, we do other things to remove the salt. To remove the salt. You know what I mean. So, even to keep that pipeline safe, let's assume it was a private investment and the pipeline owned by the water, by a private investor. To protect that pipe from being pricked, now you have oil and gas. We came to sign an agreement with yourself. We have to protect that pipeline. The community through which that pipeline will pass can prick it. I think it's happening in Nigeria a lot. Or prick it. So we need their support. So you can see, I can go on and on. That's not my intention. Mr. President and the colleagues here, we're very delighted to be here once more. And I was whispering to the Minister of Commerce here that please get hold of the green hydrogen team. Again, we chatted with the President. Get hold of the green hydrogen team. Let's start talking. Last week, Mr. President, we had a team. Our Minister of Energy was here. Minister of Foreign Affairs was here. And all we are doing is to entrench this relationship. Why do we have to buy oil from the Middle East? We're just your neighbors here. I'm sure my nephew, when he was looking for a wife, maybe he was even crossing the river, you know, illegally there. But to put a liter of fuel in a car, imagine it's coming from not this ocean here, from the Arabian Sea. What is it that have separated us all along? So as you find oil and gas, I said to my cabinet, let's go there and be on the ground floor and talk to our colleagues so that we don't have to rely on oil and gas from such a far away place. Let's trade with each other, like the president said, without going through a third country. Let's trade with each other. Mr. President, we're exploring for oil and gas. But we never utilize Angolan oil. And I was in Angola 2 months ago. We don't want to miss that opportunity with you. So you have a partner in us. You have a friend in us. And we are here to work with business. Local business, regional business, international business. Mr. President, we also want to announce here to the Namibian business community, talk to your fellow Zambian business community, because we are moving on the electrical vehicle revolution. In this region, in the region that you are chairman for defense, First Politics, Defense and Security SADC, amongst the SADC member countries, just one matter out of copper, cobalt, manganese, nickel, lithium-based minerals, within the SADC we control some of these minerals. Over 70% of global resources are endowed in our SADC region. Minos, your counterpart minister, you should have been seated next to us, so you can whisper. So on that note, Mr. President and colleagues, I simply want to say, Swakopmund 2022 Expo, And Mr. President, thank you for your invitation, and to the business communities, our regional leader here. His wife was talking to my wife when they met again. Now these ladies like to quickly create relationships to say,
Day Ichilema, President of the Republic of Zambia. Let's welcome you also.
Take your seats. Thank you very much. May I take your seats, please. Thank you so much. Your Excellency, you must always complete it and say as patron of Zambia. So, he probably knows Zambia more than myself. He lived there, worked there. And at one point, there were four presidents meeting in Kasani there, on the Fuana side, and on the Zambian side, we call it Kazungula. So it was President Gengo, President Masisi of Botswana, President Mnangagwa of Zimbabwe, and this fellow speaking here from Zambia. So after our meeting official, then we started chit-chatting. So we realized that we had a common denominator. Of the four presidents of these neighboring countries, three of us had a common heritage, and that was the University of Zambia. Very interesting. So this president was there during the difficult times in Namibia, representing Namibia, Namibia Institute at the University of Zambia. President Mnangagwa started there before me, and then myself. So there was only one Jew in Jerusalem. So, and we'll fix that. We agreed, the four of us, we agreed we would do something to fix President Masisi. So we can have common heads. So you can see how connected we are as a people. So President, thank you very much for your speech, your words. Let me recognize the ministers that are here from Namibia, from Zambia, and also the governor of this beautiful region of Namibia. Very dramatic contradiction. As the president said, you have the sand and straight into the sea. Straight. There's no little vegetation, even 1 meter, 2 meters. It's just straight. For us who come from vegetation all over, it's really a sight. Beautiful, beautiful place. And thank you for your message. Also, Mr. Urap, President of the Chamber of Commerce, thank you for your wonderful work and for putting this up. I know our leader is here, business leader, Chamber of Commerce from Zambia. Where is he? Ah, there is our brother there. Thank you very much for being here. And also senior government officials from Namibia, from Zambia, we recognize you. If I may simply say, the business communities of Namibia and Zambia, very, very happy to have you here and for bringing us together and the exhibitors at this business forum, so to say. Mr. President, I think you started it all together with those that spoke before us, and just to express our delight, when your invitation came, we had no hesitation to accept the invitation to come over here. And I'm sure now you understand why we were quick to say we will come, because it's the importance of business, the importance of the economy, but also the location of the venue. I couldn't even bring my wife here to listen to my speech. She's already busy somewhere, enjoying herself. Such is life. So thank you so much for inviting us here, Mr. President, Dr. President, and also the regional governor and the Chamber of Commerce. We're really delighted to be part of this event today. And we want to indicate that Swakopmund, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Swakopmund, I try and learn every time I'm somewhere. And what you have been putting together here for years is fundamental, it's fantastic, it's important, it is of vital necessity to the welfare of the people that put us in public offices, trade, investments. So we want to, at this early stage, applaud you for that. And really, the fact that you've been able to invite our colleagues from Zambia, with whom, since we took office, we're working very hard to work as a team, Mr. President, because I come from the business sector myself all the years. This is the first time I'm working for the public in this manner. I've worked for myself from the age of 27. So, And I was observing a very serious disease over the years, coming from business, pushing government to do things, and very frustrated with the delays. And I saw two groups that treated each other as separate, as competitive. And once we took office, we are determined to ensure that we have an unbreakable bondage between government and the business sector, because we are one. And our intent is really the same. So that's why we're very delighted here to be part of this 2022 Swakopmund International Trade Expo, SwaiTex. So thank you very much. And we know, we understand that you're here to provide a platform for innovation exhibitions, trade seminars, contacts, networking, business-to-business sessions, and I am sure you have a deal room somewhere here where transactions will be concluded before the end of the expo, because ultimately it is those decisions, it's the transactions that will make a difference. So thank you very much for your initiative and consistency, given the time when you started running this. So, and again, I want to emphasize that having my elder brother, President here, myself here, I think we are sending a clear signal that public sector, private sector working together is not an issue of, if you like, shortchanging each other or suspecting each other. This is what we would like it to be going forward. And if we're not doing it well, you will help us to do it well. I think because it's important. And it should be what is normal, not what is rare. So thank you again to the President and to the organizers. Let me indicate very briefly, Your Excellency, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, that at an occasion such as this, it's always important to recall, and the President has already done, the historical connections, where we are coming from, Zambia, Namibia, in this our SADC region, we share a lot. I already said, three presidents out of four shared one common thread. And truly Namibians and Zambians are one. Not just through the struggle days, Mr. President, and what brought us together at the University of Zambia, you as a staffer, we used to look at him and say, it's a big buana there, because we were undergraduates ourselves. But more importantly, the decision God made to put us together. I was listening to the short prayer that was given here. God took a decision to put us together, next door to each other. Very important. But also, many may not be aware, because you have a population much smaller than us. But it's very interesting that in that small population, Mr. President, you have competitors looking for partners here in the name of Zambian men looking for wives, and they found wives here. One of my own nephews, Mr. President, is married to a beautiful woman from here. And so we share a lot. We share a lot. Business, alumni, investment, trade. And I'll talk about it. You crown it all by giving us the property. A property in Namibia gave us Zambia a port here. And Wav is there. And what else would we ask for? What else would we ask for? A port that has made it easier for us to diversify our routes to the market. Traditionally, we used to go through South Africa, then apartheid disrupted that route. And we had, through KK again, Mr. President, you mentioned very well as visionary leaders that we walked the path they kept for us. KK and President Nyerere then did a deal. You know, those liked each other so much. As President Nyoma here, that group of leaders, and we got a port in the Restland. And that became our main port, and then the Portuguese disturbed us in Beira. Again, we had to ship. So this port here, Walvis Bay, is extremely important to the Zambian economy, to businesses, to all of us. And we are so grateful to the government of Namibia, to the people of Namibia. I know that decision was only possible because the Namibian citizens so decided. If they didn't, they would have said no to the leaders of that time. So thank you so much to Namibians and the Namibian government. And now, let us utilize that port together. Namibian businesses, government, Zambian businesses, government, let's optimize its utilization. And so we can better the lives of Zambians, the lives of Namibians. And again, Mr. President, we have to break this barrier, and I like your expression of that, the third generation of African leaders. I agree with you. We need to break this barrier where people in government believe that business people are bad people. That cannot be right. That cannot be right. Because we in government say we want to create jobs, isn't it? Now, how are we going to create jobs without business? Sometimes labor thinks, President was briefing me of one or two things. I won't say it much when we were still at the beautiful house there. Sometimes labor unions believe that they can exist without investors. They can exist without government. Even when governments are generally in our countries are probably the largest in single employment. But there's times that unions think that governments are a nuisance, investors, businesses are a nuisance, and they can exist without investors, and they can look after labor. And I said, which labor? Working where? Nothing. So, Mr. President and delegates, this is the importance of a platform like this. Bringing government, bringing labor, bringing investors, all of us sharing a common thread and emphasizing the point that we are one. We may sit in different corners, but actually we're sitting on the same table. And sometimes we create a barrier in between so conveniently we don't see the person sitting across the table. But yet, when you look carefully, you realize that that table would be incomplete without that person across the table. So, Mr. President, I'm emphasizing a point that this generation of leaders, democracy, we believe in, rule of law, we believe in, constitutionalism, we believe in, human rights, we believe in, but we also believe in enterprise. We believe in investment. We believe in partnerships. And my small message to Namibian investors, business people, Zambian investors, business people, there are times that you need to do JVs with the government. because government is better placed to make things happen for the greater good of the immediate employees, the greater good of the population. Why is it important to do things that have broader stakeholder acceptance? It's because if we don't do business that way, and we leave out a category of stakeholders, such as citizens, in the streets, unemployed, we're actually creating a threat on our own business. And so the best insurance policy, in my view, is to embrace different components, different facets of communities, so that our own investments are safe. The president said one thing here, and I want to put my hand up. As being part of the third generation of African leaders, that term limits is very important.
How can 2 billion people be scared off by 268 million people? Africa produces plutonium, Africa produces platinum, Africa produces uranium, Africa produces iron ore, and all the minerals that make the nuclear. And once you have nuclear power, the Western world cannot challenge you. So my message for this afternoon, which is rather irregular, take this message to all your presidents in Africa. Africa must start producing nuclear warheads. Africa must start producing nuclear warheads, nuclear plants. We have the minerals. We can buy the technologies from the West and the engineers to build these nuclear weapons. North Korea has done the same. China, Pakistan, India has done the same. Even with the amount of influence we have, 2.4 billion people don't have a seat on the Security Council of the world. Yet we are producing the minerals that are awarding the Western, Northern, Eastern world to produce nuclear weapons. So why is it that 2.4 billion people don't have a seat on the Security Council of the world? Ukraine has a few million people. They're already applying to become members of NATO. Africa, with 2.4 billion people, still does not have a seat in the Security Council. The weakness is that we are not united. But even if you don't want to be united, let's agree. Send this message to your president. Every African country must begin producing nuclear war machinery. And let's see what America will do with 54 countries that can produce nuclear. Let's see what NATO will do with 54 countries that have nuclear. Let's see what will happen when Africans come together and they begin to think in the right direction. South Africa is uranium. Congo is uranium. Zimbabwe is uranium. You can do your Googling and your research, and you'll find that Africa is not a poor country. By the way, nuclear is not only for war. Can also use it for electricity and other technologies that are out there. And I think for this afternoon, I want to send a clear message to all African leaders, particularly the Africa Union. Africa Union, Can you begin to identify countries in Africa that can produce nuclear active materials? Identify countries in Africa that have uranium. Find the closest place to those countries. And as Africa, let us build our own nuclear weaponry so that we can challenge the Western world, European world, with weaponry and technology. Not only nuclear world, nuclear technology. It also builds itself into the, what do they call it? The aviation technology, the drone technology, the scientific technology. With the minerals that you have as Africa Union, you can buy the Chinese, North Korea, American, European technocrats and engineers to help you at a centralized place in Africa where you can begin to build these technologies that can fight and challenge the Western narrative. Africa is weak as long as it is not competitive in challenging the Western world with the technology that they say they have. But we have the minerals. We have the minerals. We have the resources to build our own African nuclear station, our own African space station, our own African electrical plant, our own African technological center, and with this as the hub of the African conversation, we can begin to talk about how do we as Africans contribute not only to ourselves, but to the world that is out there. And once we have these sciences in our hands, we can, we don't ask, we can challenge, we can demand, we can contribute meaningfully to the conversation around the world. So the weakness of Africa is our leaders who constantly think that signing treaties, signing loans, and signing pieces of paper is power. America, from the time of Reagan to the time of Jim Carter to the time of Clinton to the time of Trump, the time of Obama to the time of Biden, they've constantly been managing African countries to make sure that they don't utilize their resources to protection of their environment. Hence you find that one of the treaties African leaders must sign is that they are not going to produce nuclear active materials. And nuclear active materials are the protection, the security for the future. Everyone else can come to Africa and buy the materials and produce the nuclear active materials. But you, who is producing the atomic active materials, you are not allowed to convert these materials into warheads. Russia has proved us wrong again. The Americans and Europeans are liars because Russia has nuclear active material. And they are a superpower. So what will it take my 54 leaders in Africa to hear me, to understand me, when I tell you, stop talking politics. Start talking power. How do you convert your raw atomic active material to create a security boundary around Africa? How do you buy the technology of the East, the North, and the West to develop a radar system that protects the continent? How do you protect yourself as African leaders so that you don't become a prostitute of colonial institutions that are constantly putting you into the brothel of world economic politics. How do you, as African leaders, sit around in your nice suits, big convoys of cars, United Nations, UNGA this, and you're sitting around and you have the materials to convert this continent into an active superpower with all this energy and power that is in your hands? What are you doing with it? Honorable President Mnangagwa, Honorable Ramaphosa, Honorable Genkop, Honorable Hakainde, name the rest, Honorable Ruto, what are you talking about when you sit around as leaders to talk about Africa? When will Africa come together to become a superpower and have a seat at the Security Council? A voice in the wilderness. It may seem like I'm making lots of noise for some of my educated friends. My apologies. But even in my madness, I am convinced that we are missing an opportunity of power. We're missing an opportunity of power with the resources that we have, minerals that we have, the technologies we can buy, rent, and employ. We're not doing right. But we constantly act as if we are weaklings on the economic, political, military table when we have the resources. So my message for today, every African country produce nuclear active material. Every African country build nuclear active material. Build atomic bombs. Build surveillance. Build satellites. Monitor, manage, protect your own environment. And until Africa reaches that level of converting our resources into protection measures, we are constantly going to be beggars on the world market. The same uranium, platinum, plutonium, cobalt, they're buying from us. These minerals can be used as active atomic military weaponry. Our universities, I come again, are the weakest link, because they should be advising their governments, we have this, we have this, we have this, we can do this and that and that and that. Instead of advising presidents correctly to create industries of protection and super power technologies, we've become professionals in writing proposals for funding and donor money. I would fire them, all of them. I would fire all of them. I would fire the hell out of all of them. Useless bunch of technocrats who are not tuned correctly in terms of how do we transform Africa to become a superpower. I don't know. Maybe it's just a voice of a crazy old man. But I bet you, if we can think together, plan together, study together, and learn together, 2.4 billion people with 60% reserves of the nuclear atomic material around the world, why is Africa not coming together to create nuclear warheads and satellite surveillance technologies to make sure that Africa becomes part of the Security Council And until we can determine our own destiny, our history will be written by those that are colonizing us. With those few words, I thank you. Hello one and hello all one more time. Greetings. Greetings to the tribe, greetings to the family, greetings to the residents of Al-Kablam. I'm excited, I'm happy to be here with you again on your channel. I've been quite caught up in some few things around the country, but basically the building of the palace has become my priority right now, where I'm putting things together. It's getting together. It's looking beautiful and it's great. And I'm quite excited to be here with you. While I was out for the past 2-3 weeks, I come back and I realize that the political landscape is changing. And the changes that are happening, the African needs to start thinking, and he needs to start thinking critically and very intentionally, because the Western world is not mixing its words about war. The wars that we are seeing right now in Ukraine and in Russia are based on three commodities. One, that is oil. Two, that is bread or wheat, and three, that is territory and power. And the Americans want to come close to Russia, which they know very well that it is a supernatural power in their own right. The same amount of anger that America demonstrated when Russia set its camp in Cuba. America should also understand when they set their camp in Ukraine that the response would be the same. And while they are battling on this, you know that war is money, because those that are producing the weapons, the airplanes, the bombs and everything else are making money while others are fighting. So war is profitable. War is profitable to the criminals. War is profitable to the West. And as such, the war in the Antarctica, in Russia and Ukraine, over America supplying wheat in Europe, America supplying petrol, oil in Europe, America supplying support and protection in Europe, then translates itself into the war that we are facing. I want to present my conversation for this afternoon on the population of America. Last time I checked, there were 268 million in America, and they are a continent, and including South America. In Africa, we are 1.8 billion, almost counted. But if you go to other people, they say 2.4 billion, others say 2.5 billion. That's immaterial. But by population census, Africa has more people than America. Africa has more people than Europe. And if that is true, that Africa has, just make it 2 billion people for the purpose of this conversation, 2 billion people. How can 2 billion people be afraid of 268 million people? I want to send some very reckless comments for this broadcast this afternoon. I hope you like my Nguni cow, this original skin. The original skin. I made a hat out of it. Nguni cow.
Chair,